This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Welcome to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of low-budget cinema.
The sleep of reason gives birth to monsters.
Hi, my name's Chris, and along with Jeff, we're bringing you the very best and worst of horror, sci-fi, post-apocalyptic wasteland, kung fu, and women in prison movies from the 1960s to today. Check us out at reallyawfulmovies.com, part of the Crypt TV family.
Welcome to a very special episode of the Really Awful Movies podcast, episode 62B, an interview with the godfather of gore, Herschel Gordon Lewis. The word legend is bandied about quite a bit nowadays, and often applied to those who frankly don't deserve it. Our guest today, however, is a true legend, the first man to depict gore on celluloid in a horror film, the godfather of gore, Mr. Herschel Gordon Lewis. Herschel, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be on the show, Jeff. As you're aware, a legend is an ancient work of fiction. So I guess that applies to me.
Well, no, because as we're going to discuss, I mean, what you've done is very real, but it truly is an honor and a pleasure. And, you know, I mean, you're most famous, or in some circles perhaps infamous, for the three gore films you made along with producer David F. Friedman, the affectionately known Blood Trilogy, comprised of course, Blood Feast, 2000 Maniacs, Call Me Blood Red. But before Blood Feast, you and David made a series of Nudie Cuties.
We were simply attempting to stay in the business. I had 35mm movie equipment, and I thought I'd better get some use out of it. Now, the question then is a question that is not really valid today, which was, what kind of motion picture might there be that the major film companies either couldn't or wouldn't make? Mm-hmm. Because for an independent, then, you made it the theaters or not at all. And there was a string of, I wouldn't call them first-level theaters, but certainly not Radio City Music Hall, that would play our kind of pictures. So what kind of pictures might they be? It couldn't be so far out that we'd get legislation opposing it. It couldn't be so ordinary or so parallel to what the major companies were making that there was no release possible, and that's what we were doing. And the idea of making a movie based on raw bloodshed, well, I won't call it an inspiration, but it has served me well.
After, you know, you made your series of Nudie Cuties, there came a point when you guys felt that the market was getting inundated with too many of them, so you wanted to kind of go a little bit further and find another hook, hence gore.
One of the problems of being an innovator, and I'm sure you're aware, is that the mob comes after you. And that was true then. It was also obviously true with splatter films, which we simply called gory movies. I started making these things, the industry was laughing. Who would ever go to see one of these? Once the box office results came in, then of course everybody wanted to get in on the act. And so, as is often true, when something starts, everybody is skeptical about the start. When it shows promise, everybody is enthusiastic at that point, and that is what happened. Now, of course, it's quite ordinary to have multiple bloodsheddings in a single motion picture.
But I can only imagine what it was like back in 1963 when you were unspooling Blood Feast for the first time to unsuspecting audiences. And, I mean, the reactions must have been absolutely incredible. I mean, I know you guys kind of had a bit of a promotional gimmick where you're handing out barf bags, and I think a lot of those were used.
Within the industry, originally, I was considered an outlaw. First of all, I wasn't headquartered, or is, in my opinion, hindquartered in Los Angeles. Second, we were making the kind of movie that the mainstream industry had carefully avoided.
Mm-hmm.
There were any number of legislative moves within and without the industry about nudity, about heavy violence, that four-letter words, but there was nothing that had to do with bloodshed,
mm-hmm.
because no one had ever done it. So we were, in fact, I guess, the originators, the progenitors of a lot of legislation that came up later and then subsided as it became more commonplace. And today, you will see scenes on TV shows, on normal networks, that never would have been allowed
mm-hmm.
when we started this kind of thing.
It's funny you say that, because, I mean, for example, there's that show Gotham. Have you happened to see an episode?
No, I haven't seen that show.
It's supposed to be like the early days of Batman and Commissioner Gordon and so on. And this is aired Mondays at 8 p.m., which I remember being, quote-unquote, the family hour. And,
yes,
I mean, there's beheadings, there's you know, people getting shot through the head. I mean, there's gore galore. And, I mean, you know, 20 years ago, this would create quite a furor, but now it's pretty much de rigueur. And so, yeah, as you said, I mean, you know, being the first one to do it, obviously, you know, it was something extremely revolutionary, but now gore has become, I don't want to say banal, because, I mean, there's always somebody who's going to top somebody else, but back in 1963, I mean, it was something else, you know?
Oh, yes. It certainly couldn't have been considered a standard effect. And proof of that, for example, I was using department store mannequins because that was the only way I could get hold of anything that I could take apart. Today, you go into any magic shop, they have arms and legs that flex and are rubberized. They have body parts that you... what I would have given to have something like that for realism. Now, if you go back to Blood Feast, I've often referred to Blood Feast as parallel to a Walt Whitman poem. It was no good, but it was the first of its kind.
I love that quote.
So there is a definite parallel there.
Mm-hmm.
If Columbus were to sail across the Atlantic Ocean today in his original boat, chances are he wouldn't make it. But if he did, he'd be laughed at the time he was a pioneer. So I'll settle for that kind of description anytime.
And apologies, of course, to any Walt Whitman fans, correct?
Well, yeah, it's a strange place to achieve notoriety.
Mm-hmm.
But let's suppose instead of my having made Blood Feast, Universal Pictures had come out with something like that, starring Johnny Depp or Tom Cruise or somebody. Would it have had the same within the industry impact that Blood Feast, with its zero budget,
mm-hmm.
with its lack of any talent either from acting or from production? That's what set the industry on its ear.
Uh-huh.
And with all those negatives, people clamored to see it. And they didn't go and say, oh, they didn't come out of the theater saying, oh, what a ragged pan that was.
Mm-hmm.
Did you see that jump cut? No. Hey, they pulled the gal's tongue out. Did you see that? Which meant to somebody else, I'd rather go see that or I'll be left behind.
Mm-hmm. I mean, one thing I over the years, you know, seeing you in interviews, listening to some of your interviews, I mean, I love the self-deprecatingness, if that's such a word, of, you know, when you describe Blood Feast. And, yeah, I mean, there's a certain sort of, like, outsider art element to it, to put it kindly, when it comes to some of the acting and so on. But at the same time, I mean, there is, in my opinion, and I'm not the only one, I mean, there's, of course, John Waters is a huge fan, of course, and so many others, there's a certain level of artistry that is reached, even though you say there was no talent involved. I mean, there is something.
Well, you see, you struck home with that comment, because the emphasis was never on the actors. Emphasis was never on superb camera work. Emphasis was on the effect. The star of these movies is the effect.
Mm-hmm.
And that has a tremendous impact, as opposed to saying, did you see Mustache Johnny Depp was wearing.
But at the same time, okay, I'm going to say the performances are less than stellar. I mean, okay, well, let's talk about Connie Mason. I mean, one of the your famous quote about Connie Mason, where if you took the key out of her back, I believe you said, she would just stand in place.
Well, yeah, she and I would never say we're close friends.
Uh-huh.
And we called her, and I'm not sure that she'd appear in print anywhere, Friedman's Folly, because Dave Friedman found her, if I recall, in the Playboy Club in Miami. And that had impact on Dave. He and I had slightly different attitudes toward the industry. It worked to our benefit, because each of us added another dimension the other fellow hadn't thought about. But Connie, from a thespian point of view, was not about to win an acting award.
But yeah, at the same time, I mean, despite the fact that in, your quote is saying having an instant dislike with Connie Mason, you did recast her in your next feature, 2000 Maniacs.
Well, that again was Dave Friedman's decision. I didn't care that much. I didn't care about casting at all, except for a handful of people. Mm-hmm. You're obviously quite familiar with these people. Bill Kerwin,
mm-hmm.
who uses the name either Thomas Wood or Thomas Sweetwood, and Talkie Blank, who used the name Jeffrey Allen.
Mm-hmm.
These were truly accomplished actors, and they could carry a scene. And I recall, and not just in 2000, see, in Bloodface it made no difference. Because I knew that we were either going to get kicked out of the industry or people would be talking about it. With 2000 Maniacs, it was a different story. But when we saw the business Bloodface was doing, and this again has been much quoted, I said, what if we made a decent one? Now that became difficult because Connie could not remember her lines. And when she did occasionally do that, it came out flat. So we would switch a lot of her lines to Bill Kerwin,
mm-hmm.
or to somebody else on the scene, including, for example, the little boy, Billy,
mm-hmm.
Just to add some degree of professionalism.
Right, now, and talking about William Kerwin, I mean, he was, besides being in front of the camera, he was also quite indispensable behind the camera, too.
Bill Kerwin was the ideal guy. There were two people I've dealt with over the years. He was one. Ray Sager was the other. These guys would pitch in. No matter what we were doing, they would pitch in. Whether it was taking a part suddenly, as Ray Sager suddenly became the Wizard of Gore,
mm-hmm.
or at the end of the day, picking up the cables and getting out of the location, which was important to somebody like me because we didn't studio shoot. We would shoot on the street. We would shoot in people's apartments. And we would try to get out of there before we had exasperated our hosts to a point where they'd think, get out of here! Places like that, when Bill Kerwin or Ray Sager would lead the way, others would simply join in because of that mass mob effect. So, yes, there was great benefit with those two people.
Mm-hmm. Now, with of course, Blood Feast was a tremendous success. Then you went on to make 2000 Maniacs, and as you said before, this time you said you wanted to make it good. Well, first of all, not only do you make it good, I mean, in my opinion, I think 2000 Maniacs has the best theme song ever in any film.
Oh, I love hearing that said. There again, you know the story behind that.
Yeah.
I assume you do.
Yeah, I do.
Because I had not planned to sing that song. Yes, I wrote it. I had this very talented musical group who were supposed to perform it, and that their lead singer turned out to be a high tenor, something I hadn't even thought about. Meanwhile, everybody's standing there. It was at the end of a day's shooting. Let's go. We've got to go out to dinner. So there was no question whatever. And so that's why I sang it. And as you're aware, if you look at the screen credits, I use the name Sheldon Seymour, my famous fake name. My name does not appear there as the singer. But it's really strange because to this day, including something that's coming up in a couple of weeks, when I attend one of these horror-filled festivals, I'm asked to sing the theme song from 2000 Maniacs, and I do so very gladly.
It's one of those songs that once it gets in your head, you just will never, ever, ever forget. In fact, last night, just to prepare for this interview, and I was watching some 2000 Maniacs, and for the rest of the night, I'm just going, yeehaw! You can't.
Well, that's something. I always ask the audience, I'll sing the theme. If you guys will join in for the yeehaw, and that's the way it's usually performed.
You mentioned, that, of course, Blood Feast was the first, and I guess, was it the most financially successful of your films?
The most successful? Well, dollar in for dollar out, oh yes. I've had other movies that, over a longer period of time, may have outgrossed Blood Feast. For example, She Devils on Wheels. Mm-hmm. But, here we are in October, Blood Feast will show all over the place more than 50 years after it was made, to generations who don't look at this as an antiquity. And that's the kind of achievement you don't find in a lot of movies,
mm-hmm. And but
regardless of budget.
Well, if I could just give a personal anecdote about Blood Feast, I remember when I was about 8 years old, and in my local video store, they had this incredible horror room, so that's where they kept all the horror movies, and I was scared, but I would every so often, if my mother was turn her back, I'd venture into the horror room, and I remember I remember seeing the box for Blood Feast, and it was the most lurid thing you could ever imagine, and I remember at this point, in my mind, I mean, I'm talking to the man right now, but I was like, what sick person came up with this? And then I turned it over, I'm like, oh my god, this is even sicker than I imagined, and I think that thing haunted my nightmares for days, you know?
That was the invention. Really, it was the intention. But I will also say, in defense, that I did not want children to look at this movie because I was afraid of what the results might be from a parental point of view, mm-hmm. and also from a legislative point of view. Because the only thing I was afraid of that might kill the entire concept was a bunch of bills coming up in communities, or from the MPAA, or wherever, who knows from what, mm-hmm. saying, don't see this movie. And that we never did hit that level.
Were you surprised you were able to get away with it as you did?
I sure was. Mm-hmm. But you see, what happened was, once that first audience hit the street, I knew I was home free. When we were cutting this movie, in my little cutting room in Chicago at the time, now what? People would look at this beat up old work print with grease pencil marks all over it. And so, is this a medical film? Oh boy. But then we decided to open this picture in Peoria. You know this story too, I assume.
You got it?
My figure is, it was, if we die in Peoria, who will know? As it turned out, we crocked them in Peoria. We had automobiles lined up a half a mile down the street from the theater. And that's when I knew I had hit a mother load. And that, in fact, was truly the genesis of 2000 Maniacs, figuring, my gosh, if this thing could do business, imagine what one might do that has production value. Mm-hmm. And to this day, as you're aware, of all the movies I've made, 2000 Maniacs is my personal favorite.
Yep.
But neither 2000 Maniacs nor anything other than maybe She Devils on Wheels could approach Blood Feast from the viewpoint of box office returns.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's how you keep score.
Mm-hmm. And you were mentioning saying that you would rather be remembered for 2000 Maniacs than you would for Blood Feast.
Yes. I don't want either one of them on my tombstone.
But, and then of course in 1964, then you followed up with Call Me Blood Red, another incredible movie, again, part of the quote-unquote Blood Trilogy, and this was the tale of the frustrated artist Adam.
Yeah.
Who had a very...
His real name was Gordon Oasheim, O-A-S hyphen H-E-I-M,
mm-hmm.
and we used the name Adam Sorg, and then, strangely, I used him in another movie, and he used as his name, as the actor, he used Adam Sorg. So we created something there. But as we went down the line, winding up eventually in that first group with the Gorgor girls, the one factor I wanted to make certain of was that we didn't simply repeat ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Because I look at some of the even contemporary flat Earth films. And I get the feeling that they're just making the same movie over and over and over again. And that's an accusation they can't aim at me.
Definitely not, because, Blood Feast is not the same, story as 2000 Maniacs, nor is it the same story as Call Me Blood Red. And then, even after you made those films and you split with David Friedman, you were still making wildly divergent movies. Then there was Moonshine Mountain and Something Weird, which is not really a gore film per se, but definitely a very unique film.
Oh, yeah, well, the idea was to make a movie on a commercial level. And I pity producers and directors who, they don't make movies, they give birth. And if you criticize what they've done, you're attacking their child. I don't take that point of view at all. I regard the motion picture business as a business. And that was one reason, by the way, that after making the Gore Gore Girls, I was out of it for a number of years. Mm-hmm. Yes, I have another business. It's been quite successful. So it wasn't as though I was out in the street having to sell apples to make dinner. So I was happy with what I had done, but by that time, everybody began to make my kind of movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt it was time to move on.
And, I do want to talk to you about a bit about the Gore Gore Girls, you talk about your other business, and that's your advertising consulting firm, Communicorp.
Communicop.
Communicop?
C-O-M-M-U-N-I-C-O-M.
Oh, sorry.
Communicop.
My mistake.
We sold that company, in fact, some years back, and I've been doing business for the last, 15 years or so as Lewis Enterprises, which is a much more all-encompassing name.
Mm-hmm. Now, do any of your clients of Lewis Enterprises, are they familiar with your film work, or...?
They weren't until Google exposed me. I used to lead a charmed life. And in fact, one day, the axe fell when I was speaking on marketing at a marketing conference.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody in the audience there said, "Hey, do you know there's this fella who used to make these goofy movies who has the same name you do?" I said, "Uh-oh." But that really didn't create as much of a stir as later on, once the World Wide Web became the main medium of information. Now everybody knows, and I don't care, because I'm old enough that I figure they care. It's added a certain amount of charisma to my total bio, in that it shows that I'm not some stuffed shirt sitting in an office on Madison Avenue making decisions that are way outside what the typical human being wants to know or hear about. So there's a benefit implicit in that.
So getting back, so you mentioned, obviously, before we got to the Gore Gore Girls, which was your final gore film for a number of years, and you also made The Gruesome Twosome, which probably has the best scene in film history of two styrofoam heads talking to each other.
Well, that, again, as you're aware, was a result of an accident. The person we had counting for running time was off by 10 minutes, and we're putting this thing together, and it was simply too short to be considered first feature in a double feature in a drive-in. I said, "Now what?" And that was where the talking heads came from. I had to have something to bring this movie up to proper length. So, as Shakespeare said, "Sweet are the uses of adversity."
Uh-huh.
From all that, it worked out very well, I think.
I know, it's actually a very entertaining 10 minutes, and even prior to that, your film The Blastoff Girls, you had a very interesting celebrity cameo in that one.
Yeah, well, that's our method. That is our method of production.
Right.
Just throw something in there that the audience won't object to, because they don't sit looking at their watches. A theater owner will, and going back in time, we didn't have anything. We didn't have DVDs. We didn't have video cassettes, for that matter. We made it in the theater or not at all. And it was not Maslin was then by that time in control of all the old movies, that some of these factors, such as running time, became a major item.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was also referring to in the Blastoff Girls, you had a very interesting cameo, and that being Colonel Harlan Sanders, who apparently was a bit of a diva on set.
Well, one you should have seen in a Kentucky Fried Chicken or something like that operation. And the deal, I couldn't resist it. They're PR people, whoever they were. So, do you want to have Harlan Sanders in the movie? Well, sure. That's the biggest name I could ever have. I certainly wasn't going to get any major Hollywood star. So we made this deal, and the only problem I had with him was he insisted on directing. He insisted on trying to write his own lines. He had no idea what we were shooting, but it was a lot of fun. And we finally wound up shooting a rehearsal because he wouldn't quit.
I love that story. So then moving on to The Wizard of Gore, I mean, you're talking about Ray Sager. I mean, wow. I mean, he was 28 years old when he played the Wizard of Gore. And he was, you know, obviously aged in the film. But the film is, you described a bit as a jinx picture. And can you elaborate a bit on that for me?
All right. The Wizard of Gore, as you know, Ray Sager was part of my whole team.
Mm-hmm.
And he would either act in a movie or he would be on a crew because he liked making movies. And yes, I had just used him as a tough guy, and here he was on the crew of The Wizard of Gore. Now, I had a partner in that movie named Fred Sandy. Fred was an old, and I mean old time, film guy who was a friend of someone named Samuel Arkoff.
Mm-hmm.
Sam Arkoff was the head of American International Pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And Jerry Sandy, who was Fred's son, was the AIP distributor in Washington, D.C. So Fred had some position within the industry. And meanwhile, I was beginning to negotiate with American International to handle some distribution, which they did, by the way, on a couple of pictures. So here we are at the first day of shooting, and we were shooting it in the lobby of an apartment building on Lakeshore Drive in Chicago. And I had an actor who was going to play the Wizard of Gore. He and Fred got into an argument almost from the beginning of conversations, and it reached a point at which he said, "For what you guys are paying me, I'm getting out of here." And he went to the front door and stood there waiting for us to call him back. Okay, moment of decision. I felt Fred was wrong, but he was my partner. And that overrode almost anything else. So, seeing him standing there fuming, but not willing to return until somebody either apologized or said, I'm going to do it my way, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Here's Ray Sager standing there. I said, "Okay, Ray, you want to be the Wizard of Gore?" "Yeah, sure." So we put some hair dye on his, to give him a little silver around the ears.
Mm-hmm.
And Ray Sager became the Wizard of Gore. One of the problems I had with Ray, he had no manual dexterity at all. He put a drinking glass in his hand. Chances are it'll wind up on the floor smashed to pieces. But that was not implicit in the role for the Wizard of Gore. And what I had in Ray Sager was someone with some acting talent and also a great deal of cooperation. And it's the cooperative spirit in cheap movies that really becomes much more of a major factor than it does in heavily unionized major company films in which other elements get into the arena along with somebody's cooperative idea.
And then, of course, 2 years later, you followed up with the Gore Gore Girls, and this was your last Gore film for 30 years, basically, until your return with Blood Feast 2. But, I mean, I gotta say, I think that could be my favorite of all your films. Now, it's definitely your most vicious film.
Which is Gore Gore Girls?
Yeah.
Like, in terms of the gore set pieces, I mean, it definitely goes for broke.
Oh, yes, it does. There's another factor there, too. People in the industry were saying, why do you only chop up women? I said, okay, we'll chop up some people. Now, yes, it was true in 2000 Maniacs. We had equality, I guess you'd call it. Because when we roll that fella down the hill with the spikes in the barrel, there's no question that men were getting it as well as women. But in the Gore girls, women are dominant, and that became a factor. And that, in fact, I think, contributed somewhat to the box office success. Again, we go way, way back in time to the prehistoric years of the 1960s. And typically, in a drive-in theater, and drive-ins themselves, of course, have gone to Valhalla, to that great screening room in the sky. But back at those days, it would be some man or boy dragging his wife or date to see a movie that she had no desire to see.
Mm-hmm.
Once again, time has been kind in that today there's equivalence. It's a unisex reaction. That wasn't the case then. Just as Blood Feast destroyed the concession stand business. People just wouldn't go in there. What it was about that kind of movie, I don't know. Now, today, you show a splatter film, and the concession stand is swamped with people. It's a 180-degree turn in reaction to what's on the screen. So you can't... The crystal ball is mighty murky about what the future will show.
It's interesting because talking about the concession stand business, John Waters in the documentary Wizard of Gore was saying when he saw Blood Feast at the drive-in, and then he went to the concession stand and he said the food that they were selling basically looked like the, the effects of Blood Feast, and that basically took him off his appetite.
Well, that may have been a factor then. Since I didn't participate concession stand business, I just wanted to make sure that a theater didn't lose money on our movies, which they really couldn't do. They were getting them so cheaply. But meanwhile, they would ring up box office totals that had to startle everybody. You mean this little piece of junk did this kind of business? And that did cause a second look, regardless of what might have happened at the concession stand.
Mm-hmm. So, after the Gore Girls, I mean, that was your last Gore film, and in my opinion, you completely went out with style, especially with the last little we announced with Pride, this movie is over. I mean, that's just a perfect little end cap, you know, to a career that, you know.
Oh, yeah, and you notice how we did that last wipe. I just had flipped the lid on the camera.
Yep.
Was something I would normally have had to pay a lot of money for the effect. No, not on my movies. Everything was done by hand.
Mm-hmm. And of course, you had the Abraham Gentry, you know, kind of just ending it off, and you know, a great little cap. And then, but now, I mean, you have a film in post production right now called Herschel Gordon Lewis's Blood Mania. Can you tell
us? Yes, we shot this in Canada, and as we speak, I'm somewhat embattled here because I finished my section in this thing more than a year ago, and I'm still waiting for release. Now, let me explain the genesis of that, or the background. The deal that I made with a producer in Canada named Jim Saito, S-A-I-T-O, was we would make a movie that had four pieces to it. Each piece would be 20 to 25 minutes. And I would be sort of an interlocutor, introducing the movie and making a little comment between each segment.
Mm-hmm.
Why would I do that? Because the deal that was made in Canada by Canadians with various governments, including the province of Alberta, was that I would write one of the four segments.
Mm-hmm.
I would direct two of the four segments. And so the actual screenwriting of the other three and the directing of the other two would be in the hands of Canadian people who would add that if I've ever worked with anywhere, I would go back there in a minute if the deal were correct. So once I left the scene, I was only there a couple of weeks to shoot my pieces. But then came cutting time, and I was not privy to that, nor have I been. And as we have this conversation, I've been wondering today whether I should get hold of Jim Sato and say, come on, buddy, it's getting kind of late in the day, and I would like to have this movie, if not released, at least excreted before I expire from the earth.
As a fellow Canadian, I mean, I'm talking all the way from Toronto, Canada. Maybe I'll track him down.
I know. In fact, Jim said to me he wants to introduce this movie in Toronto at one of the number of film festivals that occur. I said, fine. I love Toronto. I love the whole notion of it. But nothing has happened since then. And you, Jeff, might choose to call him and say, hey, what's happening with Herschel Gordon Lewis's Blood Mania? Because I'm certainly as interested as anybody in finding that out. I feel it was a good movie. Or at least my section was a good movie. I can't speak for anybody else because for two of the movies, I had no connection at all except to introduce them without having seen them or read their scripts. So that was totally blind. Mm-hmm. But it's not a factor. Because there was no intention of having these four pieces linked together by anything other than the type of movie they are. Now, what I tried to do and what I did was to add another element that I feel is about ready to become a major factor in this kind of movie, and that is humor. Mm-hmm. As you know, Blood Feast was totally deadpan. 2000 Maniacs had a minor touch of humor to it. Mm-hmm. By the time we got to the Gorgor Girls, humor became quite a factor. Now I feel it's necessary to separate that from movies like Scream, which are, again, totally deadpan. And they have isolated this audience from other audiences. What I was trying to do here with Herschel Gordon Lewis's Blood Mania was to have a movie that people who normally do not consider this kind of to be one they would go to see, or at least rent a DVD of.
Well, I mean, when it does come out, I can't wait to see it, and hopefully we'll see the light of day sooner than later. But I wanted to ask you, I mean, you are extremely accomplished in two fields, in the marketing field and also in the film industry. And
that's very gracious wording you just used there.
I wanted to, looking back on the legacy of Herschel Gordon Lewis, I mean, what is more, what do you take more pride in?
Impossible question to answer. It's like saying, which of your children do you love the most?
Mm-hmm.
The advertising business has been very kind to me.
Mm-hmm.
I had a little advertising agency which expanded, ultimately was bought by a big agency. It became a part of that. And I restarted, as I said, the current operating equity company is Lewis Enterprises. And Lewis Enterprises, really, my wife Margot and myself, and that's it. And yet I do business with some fairly good-sized business organizations. In the case of movies, I have never gone outside. Whoop. Uh-oh. Jeff, can you hold a moment? I got an incoming call.
Not a problem.
Just a moment, please.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
I apologize for that.
Not a problem.
Where were we when that call came in?
We were talking about the legacy, your legacy in advertising versus film, and you were just talking about film.
Yes. In the world of advertising, I do have some reputation because I've written 32 books, one of which has become sort of I won't call it a classic. It's become one that a lot of people have read. It's called On the Art of Writing Copy. It's in its fourth edition, and I'm very pleased with that book. in the case of movies, I can't say, here's Cecil B. DeMille II. All I can say is that within one little niche in the motion picture industry, I do have some position in which filmographies have begun to mention my name.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know whether to laugh or to smile or to be proud, but I have no complaints nor objections to make to either one of the two.
Mm-hmm. I mean, look, I unfortunately there's no honorary Oscar forthcoming for, you know, the first man to pick gore in a horror film, but to a certain segment of the film loving public, i.e., people like me, we basically worship you. I mean, we know.
Okay, well, I'll send the collection box out to you.
But wait, I mean,
I'm pleased to hear that. And as I will say to almost anybody right now, because I'm very much aware that time is running out on me, I do want to make one more.
Mm-hmm.
And anybody who puts a deal together, that person is welcomed to either email me or call me or whatever and see if we can work something out to get another movie going.
Mm-hmm.
But short of that, I'll have to live with what I have.
Well, I mean, we know that, you know, all the greats that we love, I mean, be it the Texas Chainsaws or the Friday the 13th or what have you, I mean, they would not exist if not for what you, the ground that you broke. And for that, that's why I call you a legend. And we don't live forever, but art lives forever. And I guarantee you that even when, you know, three generations from now, people are still going to be discovering your films and getting such a kick out of it. So I think that's an incredible legacy to leave behind in the film world.
One of the nicest things you could have said, and I do appreciate that very much, and I have enjoyed our conversation, Jeff. So if you think of something else that we haven't covered that you regard as germane, by all means, email me or call me or whatever.
Not a problem, and I want to thank you so much for granting me this interview. It's sort of been a bit of a dream to speak to you, so thank you so much for granting that.
As long as it was a dream and not a nightmare.
When I was 8, it would have been, but not anymore, no.
Okay, thanks again, my friend.
Thank you. Have a wonderful day.